Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Chof Gimel Amud Aleph by the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, "Hamakdish nechasav, person who sanctifies his possessions, vaitalav k'tubat isha, and he has an outstanding lien on his possessions from the k'tubah that he had given to his wife." Rabbi Elazar Omer, "Kishiyigershena, if he decides to divorce his wife, idor hana'a, he's got to take a neder hana'a." Tosafot over here discusses why he should take the nether and not her. But nevertheless, in the end, we focus on him being the individual that we forced to take the nether hana'ah. And the Rabbeinu Gershom takes it very literally. Nether hana'ah means that he takes the nether, that he won't get any hana'ah from this woman. But included in that Isur hana'ah is that he will not remarry her. He will not take her back as a wife. And that's the only thing that Rashi says the nether really focuses on, is that he won't take her as a wife again. Rabbi Eliezer obviously is afraid of collusion against Tekdesh, because when he divorces her, then the ktubah comes due, and the ktubah's lien on the properties preceded that of Hekdesh. So she's going to have the right to take the land from Hekdesh, and in doing so, we're worried about the fact that maybe he regrets having been makdish these items, and the way for him to get it back is to divorce his wife. And then he'll get the land through the collection of her ktubah, and then he can remarry her, and he gets the land back without it remaining in the hands of Hekdesh. Yeshua Omer, Eino Tzarich. Yeshua says, we don't worry about it, seemingly saying that we don't worry about people colluding to defraud Hekdesh. Now, embedded in this is also an understanding that when you have Hekdesh, Hekdesh does not wipe out the liens that exist. We'll discuss this more later on in today's daf. But according to Rashi, and we'll see this mentioned in the Baalei Tosafot in the second half of today's daf, believes that only Kedushat HaGuf, if you makdish an item that it has Kedushat HaGuf, then it can remove all liens that are on that item. But when there's just Kedushat Damim, like over here, where the person's makdish nechasav, there's no power to undermine or override the liens that exist. And that's why the woman's ketubah still is collectible against Hekdesh in this case. The Rambam has a slightly different view, which is that Kedushat Damim does have the effect of suspending the liens, but that's exactly what it does. It suspends the liens, does not wipe them out. Kedushat HaGuf wipes out the liens. Kedushat Damim suspends the liens until you're pudeh, the items from Hekdesh. Then the liens come back or are reinstated at the time that you pudeh from Hekdesh. So that's the reasoning behind what's happening over here. Kiyotze Badavar, we have a similar scenario, Amar Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Afarev li Shabik Tuvata. Someone who's a guarantor on a woman's ktubah, Vaya Bala Migarsha, and her husband's now divorcing her, and the husband doesn't have the means to pay her ktubah, so now the Arev, the guarantor, is going to have to step in and pay her ktubah. Yidirenu Hana'a. The same thing over here, we're going to force the husband to take a neder Hana'a in order to prevent him from remarrying this woman, because maybe they will collude to collect the money from the Arev. In order to make money out of this ploy, he will divorce her, have the ketubah come due, force the Arev to pay up, and then he'll remarry her and live happily ever after with the monies that they garnered from the Arev, from the guarantor. So the same problem that we spoke about seemingly by Hekdesh of collusion, we also worry about with regards to an Arev, a guarantor. Gemay kamiflegei. What is the machloket, the shorsha machloket between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua? As we noted, the most logical way to explain it is that Rabbi Eliezer savar adam osek nunya al Hekdesh. Eliezer believes that people collude Hekdesh. They're willing to cheat Hekdesh for their benefit. Yeshua savar ein adam osek nunya al Hekdesh. Yeshua believes that people don't collude to cheat out Hekdesh. Velaha da amar Rav Huna. What are we going to say about this memra of Rav Huna in the Gemara in Bava Batra? Shchiv meira, someone who's on their deathbed, she dish kol nechasav, where he sanctified all of his possessions. Ve'amar, and then he says, Mane leploni biyadi, says I owe this 100 zuz to so and so. Ne'eman, he is believed in that case. Chazaka, we have a belief that ein adam osek nunya al Hekdesh. We're pretty confident, or we believe that the majority of people in these situations would not act to collude Hekdesh. And therefore we believe him in this situation. So Lema, let us say, Kitanai Amra Lishmate. And it would sound from this that Rav Huna is taking sides in this machloket, and he's following the position of Rabbi Eliezer, not the position of Rabbi Yoshua. Lamar says, "Lo, that's not the case. Ad kan lo plige ele bibari." Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua only argue about a person who is healthy because he will be the beneficiary of his collusion. Aval b'shchemeira divrei hakol ein adam osek nunya lehekdesh. When it comes to a person who's a shchemeira, and there he might be colluding to cheat hekdesh, there we don't worry about it because my time up. In adam chute velolo, people don't sin to benefit others. Over there, if he cheats hekdesh, the beneficiaries are either his inheritors or, in that case, possibly the creditor who he says the money is owed to. Over here, the case of the Bari, the beneficiary is himself. So people will sin, people will cheat to benefit themselves. They're not going to do something, especially on their deathbed, when they know they're going to meet their creator at that point in time. They're not going to necessarily cheat Ekdesh in order to benefit others. So that's the distinction we draw. Now that distinction creates a huge problem here in terms of how to reconcile Ravuna's statement with the Gemara here. Because Ravuna's statement is, Shchiv Meira, by a Shchiv Meira, people do not collude against Hekdesh. The Gemara of Baba Batra is Middayek, out of Ravuna's statement, that that's true by a Shchiv Meira, but by a Bari, Ravuna believes they do collude against Hekdesh. Well then, how do you reconcile that with this Machloket, Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yeshua? We just said that in the case of a Bari, Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yeshua have a Machloket as to whether people collude Hekdesh or not. And that would mean that Rav Huna is, with regards to a Shchiv Meira Divrei Hakol, but with regards to a Bari, he's holding like Rabbi Eliezer, which would be very unusual, since Rabbi Eliezer is Mutihi. So given that, it would be surprising that that would be the outcome. But, surprisingly, the Rambam actually paskins that way. The Rambam paskins, like Rabbi Eliezer, in the case of a Bari, and says you do need a Neder in the case of a Bari, because we do worry about collusion with Ekdesh. And that's very possibly because of what Rav Huna says over here. And that the diokat of Rav Huna is like Rabbi Eliezer with regards to a Bari. So that's one way to deal with it. On the other hand, the Rosh, who's brought in the Shita Mekubetzet Ot Dalid, says that the distinction here is in the nature of the case. The Baya Tosafot later on will bring the similar distinction, and I'll point it out when we get there. But over here, the Tosafot Rosh, based on the Shita Mekubetzet, says, Aval bibari chashina niknunya. By a bari, according to Rav Huna, we do worry about collusion. He says, v'af Rabbi Yoshua modeh. And even Rabbi Yoshua agrees. Bivatrita niknunya mishom dekamrinan. The vadai loya migaresha tishto lasod knunya lehekdesh. Because a person is not going to go through the trouble of colluding against Hekdesh by divorcing his wife because the option or the other alternative is to have a she'ilan hekdesh, is to get a hetarat nidarim. And that is a much easier situation or process to go through than divorcing his wife and remarrying her if he's going to collude against hekdesh. So since that's the case, if he divorces his wife, Rabbi Yeshua says we don't worry about collusion because in that case, he opted for the route that is less desirable. But in the case of Rav Huna, where all the individual is saying is Mane Leploni, that I owe this money to so-and-so, that's much easier than going and having Hatarat Nedarim of Hekdesh. And so for that reason, even Rabbi Yeshua in that case will agree that people will collude against Hekdesh. So the Tosfot HaRosh makes it that it's actually Divrei Hakol, Rav Huna's statement, both when it's a Shchiv Meira, there everybody agrees that he's not going to cheat or collude Hekdesh because he's ein adam chote velolo, but even by a bari, everybody's going to agree that they do collude hekdesh, because over there, the two alternatives are either he has to go to Tarat Nidarim or get Sheila and hekdesh, or he just says, I owe 100 zuz to so-and-so. That's a much easier thing to say than to go through Hatarat Nidarim. So therefore, we do worry about collusion. In our Mishnah, Rabbi Yeshua says, over here, I'm not going to worry about collusion because the alternatives are between Sheilat Hekdesh and divorce. Sheilat Hekdesh is a lot easier of a process than divorces, and therefore we would not believe that if he's divorcing the wife, he's doing it to collude against Hekdesh. So that's how the Tosfot HaRosh solves the problem, and the Baal HaYad Tosfot later on, I'll point it out again, say something similar. Over here, the Baal HaYad Tosfot indicate that there is a difference in what you are attaining in these cases. That is, by the case of the Shechiv Meira, the benefit that you're providing this individual by saying Mane Leploni is that he has the right then to collect without taking a Shvua. Because in this case, the person has a Shtar, and he has a document showing that the loan was outstanding, and he can come collect with that document against Hekdesh. The only problem is that you can't collect from Hekdesh without a Shvua. When the Shechiv Meira says Mane Leploni, and he admits that that money belongs to so-and-so, he then obviates the individual from having to take a Shvua. That is the benefit that he is providing. And what Rabbi Yeshua says is that in those situations, people will collude in order just to get the person out of a Shvua. So then, by Shechiv Meira, the person won't do it because Ein Adam Choteh V'lo Lo. But by the case of a Bari, a person will collude against Hekdesh to prevent another party from taking a Shvua. He's not really cheating Hekdesh. He's just having the person not have to take a Shvua because he has a Shtar and he'll get it in the end anyway. So he thinks that it's okay just to obviate his need for taking a Shvua. And that's why he would do it. Whereas over here in our case, where it's not simply releasing him from a Shvua, it's actually cheating Hekdesh out of that land that's given. Or cheating Hekdesh out of the properties that were Mukdash, there, Rabbi Yeshua says he won't collude. So Tosafot says that there's a difference in what you're colluding to do. When it's a small item that you're colluding to do, then a person would do it, even when he's a Bari, and even according to Rabbi Yeshua. When it's a much bigger item, like over here in this case, in the Mishnah, where they're colluding for a much serious or bigger gain, over there, Rabbi Yeshua says people will not collude against Hekdesh. Those are three different ways to deal with this Rav Huna statement, the deal from it by a Bari, and how we deal with the fact that by a Bari, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua disagree. The Rambam maintains that, and therefore Paskins like Rabbi Eliezer, Tosfot Rosh, and the Tosfot create a distinction by which Rabbi Yeshua would agree in the case of Rav Huna by a Bari that we do worry about collusion. It's only in our case here of the Mishnah that we do not worry about that collusion. Now the Gemara says, Ikadamre, Bibarik the Kuliyama lo plige, that everybody agrees by a bari that Adam osek nunya al hekdesh. People do cheat hekdesh. Bahacha b'neder shudar birabim kamiflige. Question is, if you take a neder birabim, is that sufficient for us to believe that you're no longer colluding over here? Mar savar yesh lo hafara. Rabbi Yeshua believes that you have the ability to nullify a neder shudar birabim, and therefore, it's not beneficial. So the neder's not going to help. Since the neder's not going to help, there's really nothing you can do over here to prevent the individual from colluding against Hekdesh. My sabbat Rabbi Eliezer believes in the hafara. There is no nullifying of it. There is no hatarat nidarim. And for that reason, it is beneficial or efficacious against this collusion. And that's why we'd ask him to take a neder. Now a neder birabim, the Gemara argues about whether that means in front of three, like a beit din, or means in front of ten. But a neder birabim is a serious neder. And we learn from the givonim who got Bnei Israel to make a commitment not to attack them or kill them, even though they did it by deceptive means. Nevertheless, the leaders of Bnei Israel stand by their neder because it was a neder birabim. And since it's a neder birabim, there is no hatara, there's no ability to undermine it or to get hatarat nidarim. And so, Rabbi Yeshua, who believes you can get Atara, therefore it's not efficacious. And Rabbi Eliezer, who believes you can't get Atara, it is efficacious. That's the suggestion in the Mishnah. Rabbi Eliezer says, take a neder. Rabbi Yeshua says, don't bother. It's not going to do anything for you. Everybody believes that a neder berabim does have hafara, meaning hatarat nidarim, that you can undermine it through hatarat nidarim of a chacham. And here it's a neder that's done al dat rabim. The way that Rashi explains it is that the individuals, the rabim, compel the individual to take the neder. It's not that he takes it of his own volition or he articulates the neder. Rather, the people impose the neder on this individual and he accepts the neder. And you can see that in the Rabbeinu Gershom over here, she says, his kikuhu rabim lehadira. That's a neder al dat rabim. The Rabbeinu Tam in the Gemara in Gittin has a slightly different formulation, which is that Rabbim is the person specifies that he's taking the neder based on so-and-so or with these people as the trustees for this neder. And that's what it means, al dat rabim. So it's still a nether that he's taking, but he involves, brings in other people into the nether as guardians of the nether. So over there, their machloket is whether you can be matir such a nether. So Rabbi Elazar will say you cannot be matir such a nether. That's why it's worthwhile to take it, because it will prevent the collusion. But Rabbi Yeshua says you can still be matir such a nether. If that's the case, there's no reason to have him take the nether, because he can do atarat nidarim, undermine the nether, and then it won't prevent the collusion in the end anyway. Now, the Bali of Tosafot ask over here, wait a minute, when you go to do atarat nidarim, you have to be lefaret at the nether. You have to explain the nether that you took. Once you explain the nether you took, it's going to become obvious what the problem is, and the Chacham is not going to be matir the nether, so then why are we worried about atarat nidarim? So Tosafot says over here that the requirement to be mefaret the nether is not that you have to explain the circumstances, but rather you have to explain the language. You have to give the exact language by which you took the nether. And Tosafot says over here, clearly where he's nadar birabim, over there the language is not going to give away the fact that his nether birabim was done to prevent collusion. And even nether avdat rabim, the language of the nether itself won't necessarily give away the fact that it was done in a way to prevent hatarat nedarim, or done to prevent collusion. Now, that might actually be the machloket between Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yeshua in this case, which is that the way that Rabbeinu Tam explains it, part of the nether is the specification of the individuals who are the guardians of the nether, or that those people, you can take the nether. And so then, maybe through the language of the nether itself, it'll be obvious, and therefore there's going to be no hatarat nidarim because of that. Whereas according to Rashi and others who think that the nether shudar adat rabim is simply that others impose the nether on him, their language of the nether, again, is not going to give away the fact that there shouldn't be any hatarat nidarim. Whereas there are other instances, like the Gemara in Gittin gives examples of nidarim that someone has to take, including a Kohen who marries a woman who's psula, and then he divorces her, he has to take a neder al dat rabim, in that he won't take her back in order to remove his status as a halal and to return to avodah in the mikdash. Over there, the lashona neder is going to make it obvious why it is he's taking the nether, and the Chacham's not going to be matir the nether. That you don't have over here. Now, why you can't be matir a nether al dat rabim is either because the problem is that the individual who took the nether is differentiated from the people who al dat them the nether was taken. So you need their permission, but they're not the ones who took the nether. So neither party has the full control over the nether in order to be matir the nether. Or the fact is that you'll never get the acquiescence of all the guardians or the parties to this nether, and therefore you can't have here hatarat nidarim. The problem with that is that we have the position of a meimar in the Gemara in Gittin, which is halad mar meimar, neder shudar birabim yesh lo hafara, neder taken in the public realm, whether that means 3 or 10, has the possibility of hatara. Adat rabim ein lo hafara. But if it's done adat rabim, there is no hafara, there is no hatarat nidarim. Once again, it would seem like his position is based now on a machloket between Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yoshua. And let's say that his position is based on the shita of Rabbi Eliezer. Betu, Rabbi Yoshua Omer, Einu Tzarich. When Rabbi Yoshua says in the Mishnah, Einu Tzarich, he doesn't need to take a neder. That's not the language you should have used. It should say, Einu Moil Mibayle. It should say that it's not efficacious. I mean, that it's not that he shouldn't take the nether, it's just that the nether has no purpose or doesn't serve any purpose because he can be matir the nether. So the language is also wrong. Elohocha b'she'ela de'hekdesh kamiflegei. Their machloket is whether you have the ability to be shoel al hekdesh. If you make a mistake when you're makdish something, can you go to the chacham and be matir the nether? Being makdish something is the equivalent of taking a nether, similar to when you make something truma. It's also a type of nether. Through your articulation, you change the status of the item. So that neder, can it be undone when it comes to ekdesh? Vatanya. Tanya means binichuta, makdish nechasav. Vaitalav ktubat isha. Person is makdish is nechasim. And there's an outstanding ktuba of the wife. Velezomer, kshumi garsha, idor hana'a. When he divorces her, he has to have a neder hana'a. Rabbi Shomer, eno tzarich. You don't need to do this. Ve'amar Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Shimon, Hein hein divrei Beit Shammai, hein hein divrei Beit Hillel. The positions of Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer align with the positions of Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. She Beit Shammai omrim, hekdesh ta'ut, hekdesh. When you make a mistake and you're makdish something, it's binding and you cannot unwind it. It's omrim, hekdesh ta'ut, eno hekdesh. you made something ekdesh by mistake, then you have the ability to undo it. You can be matir the neder and undo the ekdesh. So the simple way to explain this, and the way that 99% of the Rishonim explain this, is that Rabbi Yoshua holds like Beit Hillel, and Rabbi Eliezer holds like Beit Shammai. And that would make sense, because Rabbi Eliezer is a Shmuti who, one of the explanations of Shmuti is excommunicated. The other one is that he is from the Beit Shammai. That's why we don't paskin like him, because he follows the Shita Beit Shammai. So here he would be aligned with Beit Shammai. And that is that Rabbi Yoshua, who thinks like Beit Hillel, that you can undo a problem with Hekdesh, then the simple solution to the problem over here is to be matir the neder of Hekdesh. And that's how the person will get his possessions back. He made a mistake, and now he can undo that mistake. Rather than colluding to cheat Hekdesh, he's better off doing matir neder, because that's a simpler process, a simpler path to getting to his solution. On the other hand, Rabbi Eliezer, who believes like Beit Shammai, that there's no possibility of being matir neder with regards to Hekdesh, his only solution that he has here or available to him is collusion. And because of that, he is going to use that option, and that's why Rabbi Eliezer is worried about collusion. So that's a simple way to explain it, and that makes the most sense, both in aligning Rabbi Eliezer with Beit Shammai, as well as the understanding of why one would take the option of collusion rather than Hatarat Nidarim. The one exception is the Rabbeinu Gershom over here, and the Rabbeinu Gershom gives the exact opposite explanation over here. If you look at the notes at the bottom, in Ot Aleph, he says, Rabbeinu Bazeh hu hipuch mikolam mifarshim zal. He is explaining this the opposite of everybody else. All the other Rishonim explain it the way we did. The Rabbeinu Gershom explains it in the following manner. I'll just read it to you quickly, which is, Im yachol zeh makdish lisha'el al hekdosho lifei chacham. If you have the ability to be shoel hekdesh, vilomar ila ite yodeya, had I known she yichola lachzor v'lagvot k'tubata min Hekdesh, that she could go then and collect her k'tubah from Hekdesh, lo hayti makdish, I would never have been makdish my items. Seems to be from the Rabbeinu Gershom, the reason he was makdish his nechasim was to prevent his wife from getting a hold of those possessions. So he's makdish the items, and now he finds out that her k'tubah supersedes his Hekdesh, and she's still going to collect on her k'tubah. He says, well, if that was the case, v'nimsa shlo ya Hekdesh. And therefore his whole Hekdesh was mistaken, because he thought it would prevent the collection of the Ketubah. Now she collects on the Ketubah anyway. And now he says, all right, well, then I really didn't want to be Makdishit. And there was Hekdesh Ta'ut, and then it will unwind itself. And then, maybe afterwards, he'll remarry the woman. He'll have a change of heart, and he'll remarry the woman. And then they're going to be the beneficiaries of this mistake in Hekdesh, the unwinding of Hekdesh. Hilkach, and therefore Rabbi Eliezer says you've got to take a neder hana'a to prevent such a situation coming about. Well, that means that Rabbi Eliezer, according to this, is aligned with Beit Hillel. Beit Hillel says that there's a hekdesh ta'ut, is lo shma hekdesh. Over here, the person's going to declare himself mistakenly being makdish his nechasim, and then he'll unwind the hekdesh, and then there's this possibility that he'll remarry his wife, and then be benefiting from the fact that his hekdesh was now undermined by the fact that he said, I really didn't think that she could collect her ketubah based on this. And so therefore, Rabbi Eliezer puts in this stopping mechanism, which is the neder. Whereas Rabbi Yeshua believes, like Beit Shammai, that hekdesh ta'ut, shmei hekdesh, and you can't unwind it. And therefore, even if he regrets it afterwards, having been makdish nechasim, when she collects her ketubah, doesn't change anything. And so therefore, there's no reason for us to have him take a neder, because he can't change his mind with regards to hekdesh. The Hekdesh is not going to be changed, or he's not going to undermine the Hekdesh in this instance. So that's the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it. Now, there's a lot of difficulty with this pointed out by some of the Achronim, which is that the Gemara on the second half of today's daf says that a woman can collect from Hekdesh. It's not a problem at all, and there's no issue with her getting hana from it. You just simply have to do a token pidyon of the Hekdesh, and she has rights to this property. So why would we worry about the fact that she would possibly collect from Hekdesh? Or what would prevent her? Like, according to Rabbi Yeshua, Hekdesh Tehut is Lush Mekdesh, and she is blocked from getting her Ketubah. Who says such a thing exists? And why is that a problem? And why does he have to then say Hekdesh Tehut in order for the woman to collect? So it's a very difficult understanding of the Gemara, but as the note in Ot Aleph points out, that might be the explanation for the Rambam's position. He thinks that the Rambam also thought the same thing. That's why the Rambam paskins like Beit Hillel, There is Tohu Bekdesh that is unwound, and there is Sheila Bekdesh, but he also passes like Rabbi Eliezer, that you have to be Noder Hana'a when it comes to a situation like this. And so, maybe, the Rambam holds like this view of the Rabbeinu Gershom. We already gave one possibility as to why the Rambam holds like Rabbi Eliezer before, in the Shita of Rav Huna. Now there's another possibility as to why Rambam holds that Halacha is like Rabbi Eliezer, even though he paskins like Beit Hillel, because he thinks that Beit Hillel and Rabbi Eliezer are aligned, like the Rabbeinu Gershom says over here. That's just an interesting view of the Rabbeinu Gershom. It's very difficult, but interesting only because maybe it supports that view of the Rambam. Now, over here, I mentioned before that the Bali Tosfot say, well, if according to Rabbi Yeshua, there is Sheila, therefore you don't need a Neder Hana Mishto Im Yergershena. He says, well, that's a little bit strange, because we paskin like Beit Hillel, that Beit Hekdesh Tohut Lo Havi Hekdesh. And then, if there is Sheila, how does Rav Huna say that by a Bari, a people do cheat Hekdesh or collude on Hekdesh? Why would they collude with on Hekdesh when all they have to do is be Matir Neder with regards to Hekdesh? If that's how Rabbi Yeshua holds over here, why won't we say the same thing in the case of Rav Huna? And so here, Tosfos gives the same answer that the Rosh gave before, which is that there's a big difference. He says, if you remember what I said before about the Shvua, he says, the Knunia de Shvua davar shu kal. It's something very light to do. V'lo yishel ha'ekdesh. It's just much easier to just say, I owe the money to so-and-so, than to do atarat nidarim or bishuel ha'ekdesh to get the result you want. Aval gabe girsha, ki ay ligaresh yishtok, delak zira, lo avid ke demas yishel ha'ekdesh. But if in the case of the choice between divorcing his wife and remarrying her, versus doing sheila ha'ekdesh, he'd much rather do sheila ha'ekdesh. So this basically comes back to what the Rosh says. Similar type of answer, that the distinction between the Bari case by Rav Huna and the case over here is how much trouble you're going through in order to cheat Ekdesh. So in a case where it doesn't take much to do it, you'd rather take that option than do the Hatarat Nidarim or Sheilat Ekdesh. In a case where it's a big undertaking, Rav Yeshua says you'd rather do the Sheilat Ekdesh rather than divorce the woman. And that way we can reconcile between Rav Yeshua and the Diuk of Rav Huna. Right now, the Gemara says, Moshe bar Atzrei, Arva de Kalatei Ava. Moshe bar Atzrei was the guarantor of his daughter-in-law's ketubah. V'Ravuna b'rei tzuver mirabunan. His son was Ravuna, was a young whippersnapper, Talmud Chacham. V'dechika le'milta. And he was under huge economic duress. He didn't have a penny to his name anymore. Amar Abaye, leke denas be'etz l'Ravuna. Why is nobody giving Rav Huna the following advice? Dilegaresh to the bitu, he should divorce his wife, v'titva k'tubata me'avua, and then she will go and make a claim for k'tuba from her father-in-law, from Rav Huna's father, v'lahadra mehadre, and then afterwards he'll remarry her, and then at least they'll have some money to spend and something to live off of. Amalei Rava, v'anan idor hana'at nan. Wait a minute, didn't we learn in the Mishnah that when someone does something like that, we force them to take on Na'at to prevent them from remarrying their wife so they can't collude against the guarantor? So, does everybody who gets divorced get divorced in a Beit Din? The way Rashi seems to indicate over here is that you could just get divorced without ever going to a Beit Din. Then nobody would know to have a Nidar Hanovi here because there's nobody overseeing the divorce process. On the other hand, the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom says it over here is, who says that the individual is going to a Beit Din of Chachamim? Maybe he went to a Beit Din of Hedyotot, and that would be sufficient to create the divorce. So the Rabbeinu Gershom seems to indicate that you still need a Beit Din, but that Beit Din doesn't have to be a Beit Din of Chachamim. So when you go to Beit Din Hedyotot, they're not going to necessarily know that you have to force him to take a Neder Hana. The Shita Mekubetzet brings a third possibility, where he says here that they are Midayek, out of a biased position over here, that the only time that you can force a Neder Hana in these situations is at the time of divorce. At the time of divorce, that's when you can force the Neder. Once the time of divorce is passed, you can't force the Neder. And that's why that moment itself is essential for creating the Neder Hana. afterwards we can't impose a neder anah on him. That's why Abaye says if he divorces her, either in a Beit Din of Chachamim or not in a Beit Din at all, then when the Beit Din gets wind of it, they can't do anything about it after the fact, because you don't have a right to force him to be neder anah after the fact. The Shita Mekubetzin himself says about this, Velo Nehirali, says, I don't think that's right at all. Because him tain, Mahuilu Chachamim, Betakanatan. That's the case, then the whole Gitakana, the Chachamim here, goes by the wayside. Because everybody can circumvent it. And it says, it's a Hilchata Belo Taima. It's a Lacha that has no logic behind it, that doesn't make any sense. And therefore, he believes that you can impose the Neder Anah even after the fact. So what the issue is over here, or what Abaye is suggesting over here is, that there's a difference between before the divorce happens and after the divorce happens. If it was before the divorce and we came to make a decision as to whether we should force him to take a neder hana, obviously Ravuna's father would say, make him take a neder hana because I don't want to have to pay out this money if he's just going to take his wife back in the end anyway. But after the fact, meaning once he is divorced, are we going to then have his father go back and say, well, now that he's divorced, I want him to take a neder hana'ah? In that case, his father's going to say, well, what's done is done. The divorce happened already. And at worst, it's going to be my son that's benefiting from this in the end anyway. He's going to be the Yoresh anyway. So he'll talk himself into it that it's not so bad, even if he does remarry the woman. So what the Shita Mekubetzin in the end says is what Abaye is saying over here is that once the divorce has happened, the father-in-law is less likely to press his case. Meaning that before the divorce, he'll press his case because he wants to protect his assets. After the fact, he's not going to go through the trouble to say, all right, well, maybe we should force him to take a neder hanah, or maybe after he's remarried her already, we're not going to force him to disgorge it because what's happened has happened and what's done is done. So that's the way the Shita Mekubetzin explains it. Now, the Gemara says, the Sofi Glai Melta de Kohen Hava. In the end, they realized that Rav Huna was a Kohen, and the whole ploy is not going to work anyway. Because if he divorces his wife, he's not going to be able to remarry her, because a Kohen can't marry a divorcee. Amar Abaye, so Abaye says the common saying, Bater Anyo Azle Anyuta, that the poor get poorer, and poverty follows those that are poor. Over here, Rav Huna was destitute already, and because he was a Kohen, he is prevented from taking advantage of this situation and bringing himself any relief in the situation. Rabbi says, Umi Amar Abaye Hochi. Did Abaye really think about providing this type of advice to Rav Huna? Amar Abaye, Ezu a Rasha Rum. Who is considered to be, the literal translation is a naked Rasha, but the concept is an individual who uses his smarts in a cunning and nefarious way to undermine the spirit of the law while adhering to the letter of the law. Which is that this is an individual who knows how to use the law in his favor to end up with the result, which is the exact opposite of what the spirit of the law is. And that's what a Rasha Arum is. That's someone who gives advice to sell off the possessions like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. This is a case in the Gemara in Baba Kama and Baba Batra with regards to a remainder trust. If an individual leaves possessions to an individual, and it says after that individual, whatever's left over will go to a second party. So the first party utilizes the assets, and when he passes away, those assets then pass to the second party, the second inheritor, the second recipient, beneficiary of this gift. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says that if the first person goes ahead and sells those assets, or wastes away those assets, then there's nothing left to go to the second party. And he has no responsibility about that. He can do as he pleases with the assets, and then the second party will get nothing. So now, Abaye says, anybody who gives advice to a person who gets a remainder trust to squander the assets or sell off the assets so that they all stay with him, and it doesn't go to the second party, that's a Rasha Arum. Because that's a person who's using the legal methods to keep the possessions with the first party, but to avoid the spirit of what the individual was trying to do with the remainder trust. This individual wanted the assets to go to the first party and then go to the second party. This first party is now preventing them from ever getting to the second party. So that's called a Rasha Arum. And why isn't this scenario just the same? Over here, you're giving advice to Rav Huna to basically use the letter of the law to his advantage to circumvent the spirit of the law, which is now he's going to force the guarantor to pay off his ketubah in order to benefit himself. And when that's not the point of a guarantor, a guarantor is there when the person themselves can't pay off, but not for him to be the beneficiary of the payments of the guarantor. And advice to Ravuna would have done exactly that. It would have broached the spirit of the law while adhering to the letter of the law. So the Gemara says, well, no, that's different because Bray shiny, it's Sumami Rabbonon shiny. It's a little different over here because it's Moshe ben Artzi's son, Rav Huna, and it's also a Talmud Chacham. So both of those reasons make it that in those situations, we do whatever we can to benefit the individual, both because the father in general would want to benefit his son, and number two is it's a Sumami Rabbonon and we want to provide a possibility for this person to continue and have a livelihood. So both of those reasons open up the possibility of doing something that would not be the straightest of ways to go about this or the most honest in terms of the spirit of the law. Nevertheless, because of these extenuating circumstances, given that he was his son and he was a servant midrabbanan, we would have given the advice in this case, despite the fact that in other situations, we wouldn't have given such advice. Mar says, why don't we just simply say that a guarantor of a ketubah is not really held accountable? He's not really on the hook for the ketubah. We'll explain this in a minute in the Gemara as to why that is the case. But here, the father-in-law was a guarantor, and therefore he shouldn't be on the hook for the ketubah at all. So why would the advice have worked, given the fact that he was only a guarantor? Mar says, kablan hava. He was not a guarantor. He was a super guarantor, which is a kablan. Again, we'll explain this in 1 second, what the difference is between a kablan and a arif. Hanicha leman da'amar, it works well according to one who says kablan afagav delet nechasim leloveh. A kablan is on the hook for the payment, even if the debtor has no possessions at the time the loan is extended, mishtabed. Leman da'amar itlay, that only if the loveh, the borrower, the debtor, has possessions at the time, mishtabed, then he will agree to guarantee the loan. Lately, lo mishtabet. On the other hand, if he doesn't have possessions, he will not be able to mishtabet. Ma'ikal meimar. Then what are you going to say over here? So now the Gemara in a second is going to go back to this scenario and discuss the difference between a kablan and an arev. And that is that, in general, a guarantor has a problem, which is what binds the guarantor to make a payment when he is a guarantor. He doesn't have any consideration that he is receiving in this case. And given that's the case, it's really an asmachta then. And he doesn't have gemira tadat. He doesn't have full intent to be mishabed nafshei in order to encumber himself to pay for this. And that's why a arev does not encumber himself in these situations. As opposed to a kablan, which we're going to see, Rashi over here believes, the kablan intervenes in the situation and gets involved hands-on, basically with the loan. And therefore, he is as if he borrowed the money. Since as if he borrowed the money, that's what's mishabing himself in these situations. So the Gemara says, okay, if he's an arev, he doesn't have a kinyan that obligates him over here with regards to the ketubah. But in this case, he was a kablan. It says that works well according to the one who says that a kablan will obligate himself when the debtor has no possessions. He still is on the hook for it. According to those that say that when the debtor has no possessions, then even a kablan is not mishabed nafshei, then what are you going to say over here? Rav Huna had no possessions. So then why was his father on the hook for guaranteeing of the ketubah? My answer is, that Rav Huna at the time that he gave the ketubah to his wife, he had possessions. He was wealthier, but then he lost it all. It got flooded. It got washed away. He lost his assets. So at the time of the ketubah, he had assets, and therefore his father was mishabed nafshei and is on the hook for it. That when a father be vis-a-vis a son, even though generally a person who has no assets, the kablan would not extend himself in that case. Here, where it's a father to a son, there is an extra relationship that exists, which will then encumber the individual or say that the individual really had gemira tadat to be the guarantor over here. Di itmar. And here's the explanation of what we've been saying until now. Arev de ketubah, divrei hakol lo mishtabed. Everybody agrees, when you're a guarantor of a ketubah, you're not on the hook for the ketubah. Kablan de balchov. If you're a kablan of a balchov, divrei hakol, mishtabed. Everybody agrees you're on the hook. Now, what is a kablan de balchov? Rashi explains on the first Rashi on the Amud that that's somewhere where the individual basically extends the loan because of the kablan. And Rashi even says that the kablan over here takes the money and then he passes it on to the debtor. So it's as if the kablan took the loan from the creditor and then handed it to the debtor, or it's only because of the kablan over here where he says, give him the money and I'll pay you back. That's why he's extending the loan. The Rabbeinu Gershon goes one step further, and we'll see that in a second. So that's why by a kablan you're on the hook. Then the Gemara says, when it comes to a arev de balchov, when it's a guarantor of a debt, the kablan de ktuba plige. There they argue. Ike leman damar, itle nechse lelove mishtabed, leitle lo mishtabed. There's some say that those situations, if the loveh has possessions, then the kablan by the ktubah and the arev by the balchov will enter himself into the situation, into the fray, and guarantee it with a full heart and gemira dat. But if he doesn't have possessions, he won't do that. Even without that, he is mishtabed nafshei. The Gemara in Gitin notes that there's also a form of consideration here, which is that the person gains a certain amount of believability in these situations, or nemanot, that people trust him. And that trust is also a consideration that creates the gemira tadat over here. So now you have different scenarios, and the main nafkamina between a kablan and a arev is whether you have to go to the loveh first. An arev is a guarantor, which basically says, I'll back up the loveh. So that means that when the creditor goes, he's got to go to the loveh first and collect. And if he fails to collect from the loveh, then he can go after the guarantor, because the guarantor is backing up the loveh. On the other hand, by a kablan, since he entered into the fray and either said, lend him the money and I'll pay you back, or like Rashi says, he got hands-on, he took the money from the creditor and then passed it on to the debtor, in that case, the creditor has equal opportunity. He can go after the kablan, or he can go after the debtor, whichever he chooses. He doesn't have to go to the debtor first, because the kablan really entered himself as a middleman in the fray, and for that reason, he can go after him immediately. So now, with regards to, again, a balchov and a kablan, there we know for sure that the intervention of the kablan makes it that he's on the hook for the money, and he's got to pay. With an arev of a ktubah, we're going to see in a second, there we have no question that he's not involved. The only question is, by an arev of a balchov and a kablan of a ktubah, what are the necessary ingredients for them to be mishabed nafshei? Do they only do it when they have a likelihood to get repaid? And that's when the loveh has possessions at the time that this happened, or the husband has possessions at that time. Or were they willing to be mishabed nafshei even without that? Even without that guarantee, assuming that the personal guarantee of the individual is sufficient for them. And the Gemara says, V'hilchata, l'acheyez b'kulu, afgav d'leitle, even though the person has no possessions, the person is always mishabed nafshei, l'bar me'arev d'ktuba. With the exception of an arev of a ktuba, d'afgav d'itle, even though the person has possessions, lo mishtabed. He is not encumbering himself, he's not putting himself on the hook. My time, oh. Why is it that he's not putting himself on the hook? So here the Gemara gives two reasons. Mitzvah kavit. First of all, he's doing a mitzvah. He thinks that he's creating a zivuk over here. He's helping them get married. So he's doing a mitzvah. Below midei chasra. And she didn't lose anything over here. So these two factors make it that the guarantor of the ketubah is just ceremonial in nature. He's doing it so that they can get married, so that the woman feels more secure, even though he's not providing any security. But nevertheless, it facilitates their marriage. And that's a mitzvah to have them get married. And in addition to that, she is not out of pocket any money. As opposed to a creditor who's lending money or giving money away and then wants to recoup that money, over here the woman didn't give any money. This is just the money she would receive in the ktubah. This is all we call a profit or found money when she gets divorced. And since she didn't have to put out anything, over there we're not going to worry about the arev being on the hook for it. Now, the nafkamina would be if either two of those was not missing, which is if the guarantor only entered the fray after they were already married, in that situation there was no mitzvah done, or in a situation where the woman brings things into the marriage, and she actually has losses associated over here, so in those two cases it might be possible that the arev would be on the hook
for those situations because he's missing one of these two factors. So in the end, what we have here is that the Arev and the Kablan, in the case of an outstanding loan, are Meshaveh Nafsheh. Their guarantee is a Gemirat Adat and a Kinyan. The Kinyan is created by the fact that the creditor relies on them to extend the loan. In one case, he's relying it to extend it to the debtor because it's being backed by the Arev. In another case, he's extending the loan because he's really extending it to the Kablan, because the Kablan basically guaranteed that he's going to make the payment irrespective of the Loveh standing. So for that reason, there is Gemirat Adat over here, because the Malveh relied on the statements of the Arev, and so that it's only equitable that the guarantor is on the hook. Plus, again, the Gemara indicates that there's some sort of consideration that comes to the guarantor that people believe in, and that he's known as a Naaman here because he's backing up and people are lending based on his guarantee. With regards to Ketubah, we're going to differentiate between a Kablan and an Arev. By an Arev, we're going to say that he's not on the hook at all, because over there, all he's doing is a mitzvah, and again, the woman's not out of pocket. In the case of a Kablan, we're going to say he is on the hook. How do you generate a situation of Kablan by a Ketubah is subject to a machloket. The Rambam just says, you do it the same way you do it by a loan, where the person says, lend him the money, and I'll make sure you get paid back. Or here he says, you should get married, and I will make sure that your ketubah is paid. So that would be the same way that he could be mishabit himself. Others believe that that's not sufficient to create the shibud here. And that's what you see in Rashi, in the top of the Amud here, that Rav Huna took metaltalei the ketubah. He gave his wife metaltalim, and the wife handed them over to Rav Huna's father for safekeeping on her behalf. So that's noseh v'notein biyad. Because the woman got the money from Rav Huna, she handed it to the guarantor, the Kablan, the father. And now the father handed it back to his son. So now he's on the hook, because he was actually a middleman here, taking the possession of the woman and handing it back to the son. And that's why he's on the hook as a Kablan. But he was actively involved, and that's what creates the Kinyan. And the Rabbeinu Gershom takes it one step further, which is, Inami shamar la chamia tein levaleich v'ani Kablan. Give it to your husband, and I'm the Kablan. Meaning that the son, Rav Huna, gave the money to his wife, and then the father says back to the woman, give the money back to my son, and I'll guarantee it. So in that case, again, he's entering into the fray where there's reliance by the woman on him for the money that she's giving out, and therefore there is midah dechasra, and that's why he's on the hook over there. Those are the ways that the Rabbeinu Gershom and the Rashi says you enter into a being a Kablan in a case of a Ketubah.
How Gavra did Zavnino Lidich say, this individual sold off all of his possessions, Vekagarsha the debetu, and he divorced his wife, Shalcha Rav Yosef Brei Derava Lekamei Derapapa, Rav Yosef Brei Derava sent the Rapapa, Arev Tnan, Hekdesh Tnan. Our Mishnah notes that about Hekdesh, notes about Arev. In those cases, we worry about collusion, and therefore we want a neder to protect the individual. Lokeach Mahu. When it comes to a purchaser, do we afford him the same protection? Amalei, Tana ki ruchla nechshev v'nezel? What do you mean? You think the Tana has to list out every possible case? He's giving you examples. One example is an Arev. One example is Ekdesh. Another example would be Lokeach. So he's not going to go list it off like a spice seller listing off all of his merchandise. He just lists examples, and you should be able to extrapolate it. And yes, by Lokeach, the same thing would be true, and we worry about collusion over here. Nardai Amre, Ditznan. The lotznan, lotznan. Whatever's in the Mishnah is in the Mishnah. What's not in the Mishnah is not in the Mishnah. Now the Baal Yitosvot asks over here, wait a minute, what is Rapapa thinking over here? We have throughout Shas that a woman is allowed to collect her ketubah from encumbered property. She has a first lien, and she's allowed to collect from the kuchot all over Shas. Why does Rapapa all of a sudden over here think maybe she can't collect from the kuchot because we're worried about collusion? So Tosafot says that the situation must be here, that he sold all his property off, and then he divorced her right afterwards. In a case where he sold his property, and then years later he divorces her, over there it's no question that the woman has a right to the property, and she had a first lien, and she can go after the kuchot. Over here, there's a little circumstantial evidence that there's something amiss by the fact that he divorced her immediately after selling off all of his assets, and now they're going to go collect from the kuchot. So that's why Rav Papa thinks that maybe over here, we do worry about collusion. Amar Rav Misharshia, my taima de Naradai. What's the reasoning behind the position of Naradai? Bishlam Ekdesh Mishum Revach de Ekdesh. The reason we intercede on behalf of Ekdesh is because we don't want Ekdesh to lose out. Arev Nami Mitzvah Udaavid. Also, the Arev is doing a mitzvah by Vlav Midei Chasra. And in addition to that, the woman's not losing anything by the Ketubah. So in that case, we want to protect the Arev from losing out. So in the case of Hekdesh, where we don't want Hekdesh to lose from what was given to it, and in the case of the Arev, where he did a mitzvah by the Ketubat Isha to help them have a zibug, and the woman didn't lose anything, over there again, we're going to protect the Arev. Elu Keach, why do we have to provide protection for the purchaser? Michde, Mide Yoda, he knows the Cholchad V'chad Ikalei Ketubah. Every married person has a Ketubah outstanding against them. Every married person you know has a wife with a lien on all his property. Amai Nezel V'Nizban. Why did you go and buy the property? Ihu Dafsina Nafshei. You didn't take the proper precautions. You caused your own loss. By Elokeach, we don't need to provide protection because he assumed that risk. He knew that there's an outstanding Ketubah, and at some point there could be a claim for Ketubah. When he buys the property, he's got to leave sufficient property behind to have the Ketubah covered. If he doesn't do that, that means that he's assuming that risk. If he assumes that risk, we're not going to provide protection from him when he was negligent in assuming that risk. And that's why the Naradai believe that we don't afford that protection or worry about collusion in that case, and you don't have to take a neder hana in that situation. All right, next Mishnah. Hamakdish nechasav. Vaitalav ktubat isha ubal chol. First, it's Makdish's possessions, and he has an outstanding ktubah to his wife. Rashi over here says it's the case where he divorced his wife before the Hekdesh, so we don't worry about collusion. And he has an outstanding creditor. Both of them have liens that precede the liens of Hekdesh. Inisha yuchala leglevot ktubatam in Hekdesh, lo bachol bet chovot. Neither of them can go and collect from Hekdesh, because the property is with Hekdesh now. Ella, hapodeh, pudeh, the person comes to redeem it, and redeems it, amanat liten lisha b'ktubata, ublachol chov et chovot. To give the woman, oh, it's rightfully hers in terms of the ktubah, and what is rightfully the creditors for him. Hekdesh tishim maneh, if he was makdish 90 maneh, v'yachovo mea maneh, and his outstanding loan was for 100 maneh, meaning exceeds the value that was given to Hekdesh, then mosivo dinar, he pays 1 dinar, upodet nechasim ha'elu, he redeems these possessions, amanat liten lisha ktubata l'balchov et chovo, to pay the woman for ktubah, or pay the creditor's outstanding loan. According to the way that Rashi explains it over here, this latter piece of the Mishnah is an example of what was stated earlier in the Mishnah. Earlier in the Mishnah, we said that apodeh podeh, the one who wants to redeems it, and once it's redeemed, then they can collect from it. Ketzad, what's an example of that? So that's what Rashi explains it. Therefore, the Bayit Tosafot understand that Rashi's explanation over here is that the person paying the money out is the Baal Chol. It is the creditor. The creditor basically forks out another dinar, lends another dinar, in essence pays Hekdesh a dinar, and through that he frees up the assets, and in freeing up the assets, then he can collect his loan from those assets. That's how he explains it. The Baal Tosafot disagree and say that that's not what's meant over here, but rather what's meant over here is that the creditor lends money to the loveh, to the Baal, to the owner, and then the owner redeems the property. And then when the owner redeems the property, he then gives that property to the Ketubat Isha or the Baal Chol. So Tosafot disagrees that it's the creditor who's doing the redemption. He thinks it's the debtor doing the redemption. And the creditor lends him the money to do it because it's to his benefit to have the debtor redeem or do the pidyon. That's the Machloket here between Rashi and Tosafot. There are others who believe, and the simple reading of Rashi, I don't think, reads like Tosafot. And I think Rashi is saying the same thing as Tosafot, that it is the creditor who's lending the money to the debtor, and it's the debtor who's redeeming it. In addition, we said before that Rashi says that the latter half of the Mishnah is an example of the first half of the Mishnah. And there, the Bali Tosafot disagree, because they say that it doesn't really make so much sense. When it says in the first half of the Mishnah, podeh, podeh, makes it sound like it's a third party. It's not the owner, it's not the debtor, it's not the creditor. It's some other third party that's coming in to redeem it. Now, why would any other third party come in and redeem it if, like the second half in the Mishnah, the value of the property is below the outstanding debt or below the value of the Ketubah? In that case, he's going to get nothing for it. So therefore, Tosafot believes the first half of the Mishnah is speaking about the opposite case. It's a case where the outstanding debt is 90, or the Ketubah is 90, and the property that was Nikdash was 100. So another party comes in and redeems the property. When he goes in to redeem the property, he only has to redeem 10 dinar worth of it, or 10 zuz worth of it, because that's the excess amount that he's going to be able to keep. The remainder is going to go to the Baal Chov, or the remainder is going to go to the Ktubat Isha. And that's what the Mishnah says. You don't have to add anything on besides that, because he's already paying for it. Since he's already paying for it, that covers the pigeon over here of the entire item, even though he's only paying for the excess amount above the value of the loan, or about the value of Ktubat Isha. And that's how the Tosfot explains the first half, and he says the Lashon is supportive of that. Because it says over there, apodeh, it doesn't mention anything about a dinar over there. And number two is, it says that once he's podeh, it's almanat. With the condition, or on the understanding that he's going to give a portion of it to the Ktubat Isha, and a portion of it to the Baal Chov, because his small amount of money is going to redeem the whole property over there. The last thing is that Rabbeinu Gershom notes that the Chiddush in the latter part of the Mishnah is that afalpi, that you would have thought in a situation where the value of the Ekdesh does not equal up to the loan outstanding, that maybe we would not redeem it at all. I would say to him, since you're not going to get repaid in full anyway, why not wait till there's more property involved rather than take it away from Ekdesh? So that would have been the Havamina. The Mishnah comes to dispel that and say, afalpi, even though in this situation you're not going to get the full repayment, we still allow you to take it away from Ekdesh and cover whatever you can from the outstanding loan or the outstanding tuba. Now the Gemara says, Lamin li meimar hapodeh podeh. Why do we have to say over here that the individual is podeh? Why does he have to redeem it at all? Meaning that the properties, as Rashi says over here, really are not encumbered to Ekdesh at all. The people here, whether it's a creditor or the Isha, have liens that preceded that of Ekdesh. And therefore, the property wasn't the owner's to be Makdish. And the Hekdesh should never have taken effect. That's the nature of the question. The answer is, Mishum de Rabbi Abo. Because of Rabbi Abo. Dama Rabbi Abo, Shalo Yomru, Ekdesh should say, below Pijon. So that people don't say that Ekdesh can leave the hands of Ekdesh without being redeemed. So now, Rashi, and this goes back to what we discussed at the way beginning of today's daf, that Rashi said that Hekdesh Damim, and Tosfot mentions this Rashi over here from the Gemara in Pesachim, that Hekdesh Tamim does not have the power to undermine a lien. And that means in this case, the Hekdesh Tamim is not effective at all. And he learns it from Rabbi Abo. Rabbi Abo says the only reason you have to redeem over here is Maratayin, because we don't want it to look like Hekdesh was taken away without any redemption, that people think you just take from Hekdesh without having redeemed it. That's not true, and therefore we force you to redeem it. But that's the only reason you have to redeem it. Otherwise, Hekdesh has no rights to this property because the lien of the woman in her ktubah or the creditor with his debt outstanding preceded that of Hekdesh, and Hekdesh is not chal and does not ruin their shibud, does not ruin their lien. That's what Rashi learns from Rabbi Abo. Only by Kedushat HaGuf does it have the power to undermine the lien. Baal Yeh Tosfot over here then asks, what about Metaltalim? That's true by Karka that the lien is not undermined by Kedushat Tamim. What about Metaltalim? If a debtor sells off metaltalim, the creditors have no right to go after the metaltalim because they're not encumbered to the loan. The only thing that's encumbered to the loan is the property or the fixed assets of the individual. By Hekdesh, do we say the same thing? That if he gives it to Hekdesh, it's no different, and therefore the creditor here, or the Ktubat Isha, would not have the rights to go after those metaltalim. Or do we say that they still have rights to go after the metaltalim because Hekdesh had no rights to this money? Because it was really belonging to them, they were the first parties to get paid. And Tosfot comes to the conclusion that the Mishnah makes no distinction between Karka and Metaltalin over here, and therefore he thinks that across the board, Dushat Damim is not Chal, not on Karka, not on Metaltalin, when there's an outstanding lien that is there. That is the view of Rashi. On the other hand, the Rambam, as we said in the beginning of today's daf, believes that Dushat Damim does have the power to undermine a lien, but not like Dushat Aguf. Dushat Aguf wipes out the lien. Dushat Damim suspends the lien, and it suspends the lien until Hekdesh is taken out of the picture. So over here, Rabbi Abahu is basically a leniency of Chazal that say that we allow you to redeem the Hekdesh over here in order to reinstate the lien. Because once you've reinstated the lien, then you can collect the money from it, or you can take your money from it. And that's the meaning of Rabbi Abahu over here, that Lamin Le'a Podeh Podeh. According to the Rambam, the question of is, why does a pidyon of a de minimis amount help you in this situation until you've redeemed it at its full value? That's the nature of the question. The answer is, Rabbi Abo, that over here the Chachamim gave a special dispensation that allows you to redeem Hekdesh at below its market value, in order to reinstate the liens of the individuals and not hurt these individuals. That's the way the Radvaz explains it. On the other hand, the case of Mishnah says that the Havamina of a Podeh, Podeh, is that you need a third party here. And the Gemara's question is, why do I need a third party? Why can't the Isha or the Baal Chov redeem it themselves? And the answer is, Rabbi Bo, that it has to look like a pigeon. We want to make it look like there's real redemption over here in order to prevent it becoming a zilzul and hektesh, and then people will take hektesh without any pigeon. Mar says, Matita in the local Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Our Mishnah is not like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. The Tanya, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Mer, Maya Chovo keneged hektesh podeh. If his loan is the same value as the hektesh, meaning the hektesh will cover his loan, if you redeem it, podeh, then you are podeh. Vim lav enu podeh. And if not, we don't allow you to redeem it. Rashi over here brings two possibilities as to why we would not be podeh. The one reason is that because if the land that was given or the property that was given to Hekdesh does not equal the chov, that means when the creditor lent the money, he was not relying on this collateral to extend the loan. Because if he was really relying on the collateral, he would have made sure the collateral equals up to the value of the loan. The fact that this collateral is less than the value of the loan shows you that he didn't really rely on the collateral. He really relied on the commitment of the individual to repay the item over here. And that's why he doesn't have a right to go and collect it from Hekdesh when the collateral is worth less than the loan itself. That's one reason Rashi brings. He brings a second understanding, which is Vim Lav Enu Podeh. If the item is equal or close to value of the loan, then we force you to redeem it. But if it is not close to the value of the loan, we don't make you redeem it at all. That's what it means, imlav eno podeh. Eno podeh doesn't mean you can't. It means you don't have to. You can just take it without redeeming it. The reason being is that because in the case where the value is very similar to the loan, over there it looks like you're redeeming hekdesh. And so therefore we're going to force you to do some semblance or show of a redemption, because it looks like you're taking out its true value, because you're taking it for the chov, which is at the same value as the land. On the other hand, in a situation where the value is different than the loan itself, there you don't need to redeem it, because nobody's going to make mistake that you're redeeming the land. It's clear he's collecting it for his loan, and not because he's redeeming the property at the value that is associated with the loan. So that's the two ways that Rashi explains it. And Rashi favors the first way, which is, that when it says, it means you can't redeem it, not that you don't have to redeem it. The Baalik Tosafot bring both of Rashi's explanations in favor of the second one. He says the Tosafta sounds like the second way that Rashi explains it. Then the Gemara says, Virabonon. What about the Rabbonon? Ad Kama. How far can the differential for the Rabbonon be between the level of the loan and the collateral before they start to say that this collateral really wasn't collateral for the loan? Amar Rav Huna Bar Yehuda, Amar Rav Sheshet, Ad Palga. Until 50%. Meaning that a person will lend against collateral that is up to 50% of the loan value. Once it's below 50% of the loan value, he's no longer relying on the collateral. He's then relying on the goodwill or the promises of the debtor to repay it. At 50% or higher, then the collateral is a significant part of why he's lending the money. And therefore, he can go and collect it from Hekdesh. So, but they do have a cutoff where they do agree with Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, and that is at the 50% level. And that's what Tosafot says, Yeshli Yashav, et shtei lishanot. So, I now have to explain both explanations over here, according to the Rabbanon. And like I explained over here, which is one possibility, is that the value of the collateral is so low that he's not relying on the collateral. And the Lishna Batra is that since the differential is so big of 50%, nobody's going to make a mistake that you're redeeming this item, and therefore you don't have to pay for the redemption at all. That's two possible ways to explain this Gemara. Next Mishnah. Afal pi shamru chayvei arachin mimashkanin otan, that when it comes to chayvei arachin, we take collateral to force them to pay for it, and if they don't pay for it, we use the collateral to pay for it. Nonim lo mazon shloshim yom, when you go to take the collateral and you basically foreclose on his assets, we leave him a certain amount to live off of. And that is, we leave him 30 days worth of mizonot, and we leave him ksut shtemasar chodesh, clothing for 12 months. So we leave him his basic necessities, which is food for the next 30 days, and his clothes for the next 12 months. Mita mitzat, and we also leave him a bed with its sheets and comforters and pillows. The Gemara in Baba Metzia says you have to leave him actually two beds. One bed to sleep on, and another bed to sit on and eat on. Visandalav, his shoes. Utfilav. And his tefillin, lo, avalo li ishto. You leave it for him, but you don't leave any of these items for his wife, or for his children. If he is a craftsman, we give him two utensils, or two kelim that he does his work with, we leave him two of each item. Charash, a carpenter, nonim lo shnei matzadim, or the Girsa of Rashi is matzadin, and Rashi translates it as an axe, others translate it as a plane. Ushnei megirot, Rashi translates it as a two saws. So you leave him either two axes and two saws, or two planes and two saws. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, imhaya ikar, if he's a farmer, noten lo tzmado, then you give him a pair of oxen to work the fields with them and help him out with his farming. Chamar, if he's a donkey driver, noten lo chamoro, you give him a donkey to do his work with him. Hayolo min echad mirube, u min echad muat, if he has one utensil, so for instance here he has three or four saws, and he only has one axe, we don't say, okay, sell off one saw, and then keep two saws, and then use that money to buy a second axe. We give him two saws, because he has three saws, we give him two, we take away one. What he has from the muat, he gets to keep, meaning he keeps the one axe. And so we'll see in the Gemara tomorrow, that's because whatever he did till now, he'll continue to do. He only had one axe till now, so he has to live with it. Rashi, at the beginning of the Mishnah, notes, that even if he doesn't have the items that are enumerated in the Mishnah here, we leave him money to buy it. So that's the contrast between the beginning of the Mishnah, where those basic necessities, if he doesn't have them, we will then leave him enough money to buy those items. The second half of the Mishnah over here, if he, whatever tools he has, we're not going to allow him then to liquidate some of his tools to buy other tools, because however he may do until now, we're going to leave him. Things that he has more of, then we're going to leave him with two of them and take away any excess above that. A makdish nechasav, someone who's makdish all of his possessions, malin lo tfilav. Then we, according to Rabbeinu Gershom, notnim lo tfilav, his tefillin are included, they're part of his possessions, and they go to Hekdesh. According to Rashi, his malin lo tfilav means that we allow him to redeem them and to buy them back. We give him a price and tell him he's got to buy them back so that he has tefillin to use. So the Gemara here wants to know, my time up. What's the reason of our Mishnah? Why do we give him a sufficient livelihood to live off, and then only in excess of that take away his possessions? That's because the Pasuk says, Imachu me'erkecha, dechachayeyu me'erkecha. The word who, we're learning to mean, hecheyeyu. You should give him to live, me'erkecha, from the arachin. Meaning that before he gives the arachin will provide him a livelihood. So whatever he needs for that basic necessity will be first. And then only afterwards will he pay the arachin. Avalo ishto banav, not his wife and not his children, my dama, because it says, who me'erkecha, avalo ishto banav me'erkecha, says that he gets paid out of the arachin, meaning that we take away from the arachin in order to pay him, we don't take away from the arachin in order to support his wife and his children. How come the rabbanon don't agree with him? Hanu lav klei emunut ninu, ela nechasim ninu. Says those are not utensils of a trade or a craft, those are possessions. And therefore they are subject to foreclosure, not like the tools of a tradesman or a craftsman, like the saw or the axe, which are tools that are directly used in a craft. These are possessions that help the individual to plow his fields and work his fields, but that doesn't make him into a craftsman of sort or a specialty that needs his utensils. Donkey driver just needs a donkey, and probably working the field needs oxen, but that doesn't make them the tools of their trade, but rather their possessions, and they're using their possessions to make money. In that case, we're going to confiscate their possessions like any other possession that's not a basic necessity. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots, five lines down on the top of Chav Dalet Amud Aleph.